My name is Dr. Chris Jenkins, and I am the CEO of the Orianne Society and the host of the Snake Talk podcast, the podcast where you learn about nature's most feared, maligned, and persecuted animals. I invite you to listen to this conversation, and maybe you'll find that what you perceive as fear is actually rooted in a deep fascination. Welcome to the Snake Talk podcast. I am sitting here with two really amazing people who I've known for quite a while now, Freddie Antonio and Michelle Hoffman. I've worked together with both of them at different times, but all focused on conservation of this amazing snake, the Eastern Indigo Snake. And so I'm excited to talk to them today about that. We're going to talk, in particular with Fred, we're going to talk a lot about the origins of a breeding program to restore this species in places where it's gone extinct. And then we'll talk a lot about Michelle. We'll talk about that same breeding program, but we'll kind of talk about the current status and the future. So I do go back quite a long ways with Fred. When the Orianne Society started, we had this grand vision. I mean, it was really a vision of Orianne herself, the young girl who inspired the organization, really thought that captive breeding and introducing or reintroducing the snake was going to be important. And so we developed programs around that. But for the first couple years of those efforts, we, the Orianne Society, we really had a lot of trouble getting that off the ground and getting a facility built. And so I met Fred. I think we met Fred. Where did we meet at Itchoue? Where did we meet? I'm trying to remember.
Either that or the one meeting that we had on the little island off Georgia. What was that? Durian?
Sapelo. Near Durian, yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I met Fred there probably 10 years ago, and we needed a real change, a real insurgence to make this breeding program happen. So Fred decided to come on and help us start this breeding program for indigos and build this center. And so I'm real excited to talk with him about that today. And then I've been working with Michelle in more recent years as when Fred retired, she took over the reins running this breeding program, and she's the one that's currently leading it today. So I think we're going to have a great conversation. And I'm going to start out with you, Fred. Do you want to just give me a little bit of an introduction to who you are and what you're doing these days?
Sure. And thanks for the opportunity. This is kind of an interesting perspective going back. And I went to some of the things that I had written up early on about the project and was kind of surprised about, all the things that as an organization, we've accomplished in bringing the OCIC together. Myself, I was born in Akron, Ohio, moved to Arcadia, California, Southern California in the first grade. And then went to Montana State University in Bozeman, Fish and Wildlife Management. And after 5 years in the Montana snow, I moved to Florida. And partly because, Florida has such an incredible herpetofauna. You know, everything from just an amazing array of turtles, tortoises, crocodilians, and especially snakes, which has always been my primary interest. When I was a kid, I used to, my brothers and I would go down to the LA Zoo and we'd run to the reptile house from the front gate. And the big exhibit that always like fascinated me was the Eastern Diamondback exhibit. It was called the Florida Diamondbacks. And compared to our California snakes, these were like huge rattlesnakes. And so that was a, kind of a very big influence. When I moved here in 1975, Started working at Central Florida Zoo. I have three kids, four grandkids, and I've just always been very passionate, very obsessed with all types of wildlife and zoo work. So my my career has been you know, pretty much totally in the zoo field, zoo herpetology.
That's great. So Montana, huh? I, as you know, I lived out in the Northern Rockies for quite a while, yeah. And it is not Florida from a herpetological perspective. I always found it was, I found it was nice in terms of the low diversity, but the abundance of the animals, you know, oftentimes with these Great Basin rattlesnakes, for example, we could go out and find just, you know, really, really high densities of them. So when you lived in Montana, were you able to get out much and look for snakes, or were you just kind of focused on your studies?
Well, I guess my main outdoor activity was fly fishing. We had the Madison River right there close to Bozeman and just great trout fishing. But I never really came across any concentrations of rattlesnakes like you did over I guess with Lutosis in Idaho. But the one thing that did always amaze me is when I'd go out early spring, you know, in between, you know, melting snow banks, there would be these dark rocks, and every once in a while you could come across a prairie rattlesnake basking on the rocks in the sun surrounded by snow. And it was just always an amazing contrast of, you know, how you usually picture, you know, snakes in the wild.
Yeah, that's quite an image. I wanted to also go back to something you said. You talked about these Florida diamondbacks, I believe you called them, that they had at the zoo in California. Yeah. And, you know, I remember being at your house there in Florida not too many years ago, and you taking me into the backyard you know, almost seems like you recreated that Florida diamondback, if you will, zoo. I just wonder if you could tell a little bit about your personal, you know, how you've been keeping snakes outside of professionally, but personally, what you've been doing breeding wise over the years.
Well, it started quite young, actually, my fascination with snakes. You know, I moved to California in the first grade. That following summer, my brother Dave and I went back to visit our grandparents. They had a little farmhouse out in Ohio, and they had a little creek going through their backyard, and with a little wooden bridge going over. And I was in the backyard, and Dave was out on the bridge, and all of a sudden he starts yelling, "Snake!" And I go running down to the bridge, and we look down into the water, and there is a submerged water snake just sitting on the bottom of the stream. And I remember, you know, I was 7 years old at the time, but just my whole brain started firing. I just couldn't believe what an amazing sight I was seeing. And so Dave sent me a postcard that he came across a couple months ago. And it was one that I had written back to my parents in California. It said, "We have a snake." And I drew a little picture of a snake in an aquarium. at 7 years old in 1959. And so I've actually been keeping snakes ever since then. And when in Southern California, Helleri, the Southern Pacific rattlesnake, was like the snake that was in the San Gabriel Mountains right before behind where I lived. And so that was always the one, that and Zonata, the mountain king. You know, if you could go out and see those, it was always super amazing. And so I met a fellow, Barney Tomblin, when I was in the sixth grade, and he had a dealership in Monrovia called Western Zoological Supply. And so I hung out over there a lot, just seeing all these incredible snakes and lizards and crocodilians from all over the world. And so there was just this thing in me where I had to, you know, have those and take them home and look at them and study them and feed them. And it was just you know, a real passion. So, and then when I went up to MSU, I took some pop adders and Russell vipers just to have in the dorm room and things like that, which, you know, some people didn't really appreciate. But you know, it became kind of a focal thing, you know, and just, you know, getting other people, you know, kind of interested in snakes and things like that. And so from till that day till now, I've always had reptiles at home. I've got some Eastern Diamondbacks now, some Mangshan Vipers from China, and a few other things. But yeah, I expect I'll always have snakes personally. You know, they're just fascinating, and they just are unexplainable. It's just really amazing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. I've had snakes at least most of my adult life, and probably will till the end. So you moved from Montana to Florida, probably a shocking in a lot of ways from a climate perspective, yeah. From a diversity perspective. Yes. And then what prompted that move? I don't know if I missed that, but were you coming to Florida for a particular job or to continue your education? What was that? Or do you just love the diversity of snakes?
Yeah, it was mainly because of the herpetofauna that was here, you know, that I've always, you know, ever since a kid was, you know, I mean, you'd see these old movies, you know, about swamps and, you know, all types of stuff. And it was like always, you know, really fascinating. And I was staring at a map of Florida, and there is this is how naive I was, but there was a little town in South Florida called Homestead. I said, wow, maybe I could go there and homestead. Well, yeah, that wasn't quite the scene, but no, I came to Florida. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a job, and just started, you know, kind of driving around the state, you know, looking at things. Back then, there was a lot of roadside zoos that had, you know, of course, a lot of reptiles and alligators and huge softshell turtles that they had had for years. And Ross Allen, Silver Springs, Bill Haas, Miami Serpentarium, a lot of reptile dealers in Florida. And so it was just kind of almost a mecca of a blend of a lot of different, you know, approaches and facilities, you know, that were very reptile oriented. So it was a great spot to land. And I've been here ever since.
Great. There's one last piece, you know, from your career path and your history that I do want to touch on, because I think it's interesting, and some of our listeners might find it interesting as well. And then we'll get on to talking about the breeding program, the development of the breeding center. But, you know, so I know you spent a fair amount of time at is it Santa Fe College? Is that correct?
Yeah, it was Santa Fe Community College Teaching Zoo. I think now it's Santa Fe State College Teaching Zoo.
And basically, as you mentioned, it's a teaching zoo. So it's a program where people can go to get trained in preparation for working at zoos. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a 2-year vocational program. Now they're directly linked into a 4-year degree. And when I first came here, I started working at Central Florida Zoo. They had just opened a new site, and I worked there for 3 years, went to Dallas Zoo, worked under Jim Murphy, and then came back with FWC here in Florida and worked on a Dusky Seaside Sparrow project, which unfortunately is now extinct, but it was the first time that bird had been brought into captivity to captive raise for reintroduction work. And then over to Santa Fe. And actually we took that Dusky Seaside Sparrow project over to Santa Fe at the same time. So I was there for about 10 years. During that time, about 450 students went through the program. It had both an academic side, still does, a very, very good academic side. And then they have a small zoo there where the students can get hands-on husbandry training, handling, restraint, you know, operant conditioning, you know, all the good things that go with good zoo work. And so the students that came through the program were interested in working with zoos, and their placement rate was super high. And we got a lot of good feedback. And I think that program was actually started in 1974, and it's still going today. Very, very, very strong.
That's great. And I'm assuming it's fairly unique. Are there a lot of these around the country and the world, or is this
a few one of them a few? A few of them have popped up. Some of them have different emphasis. There was one in California that was more into, you know, animal training and kind of, you know, a different angle on it. Santa Fe was always more of a science approach, and really took in, you know, current techniques for, you know, husbandry and behavioral aspects of zoo animals, of animals in captivity. And so, and the staff up there was always really great, still is, and it's just a great program. But there are other ones around. I really don't know that much about them at this point.
Great. Well, I do want to talk a fair amount about Central Florida Zoo as well, because they are just one of the absolute key players, great partner, and certainly a zoo and a conservation-oriented organization that everybody needs to check out. But I think we're going to revisit that when we talk a little more in depth with Michelle, and Fred, you can certainly chime in there because I know you've had a long history at the zoo. But let's talk a little bit about the development of the center that is now kind of ground zero for breeding of eastern indigo snakes for the reintroduction efforts to restore the species in the portions of its range where it's gone extinct. And I mentioned earlier, first of all, the center is named the Orion Center for Indigo Conservation, and that is linked to our organization, obviously the Orion Society. And this Orion, the young girl who was the inspiration for the creation of the organization, really thought, and her father thought, that a captive breeding program would be an important component. So it's always been something since the very beginning. It's always been something that we had interest in. And to, as I mentioned, we also had kind of a couple of years there where we were really trying to get this off the ground. And without getting into a lot of detail, you know, we had a staff member whose job it was to you know, move to Florida and to get this facility built, and it just wasn't happening. And so we needed to bring in a closer. And that's when I met Fred Antonio. And he, it was really incredible. I'm forever grateful and just have an incredible amount of respect for what you did in a very short amount of time. And I want to talk a little bit about that today. So, you know, the concept from our perspective was a breeding center for indigo snakes. But I wanted to hear your thoughts, Fred, on as you were really starting to develop the concept of the facility as part of a bigger, broader conservation effort, but the concept for the facility, what was your thought process in terms of, I guess, first, you know, why it was important, but also maybe getting into, you know, what some of the important components that went into the concept in your head to make this a successful facility. So just tell us a little bit about the concept.
Well, you and I first started, you know, talking seriously about, creating a breeding center for indigos, I think when I was at Central Florida Zoo. And I think our connection really initially came about because I was the AZA stud bookkeeper for indigo snakes. And so, you know, I kind of had the data at my fingertips on what that zoo population was all about. And then, you know, as we kept talking and you were creating a vision for the organization and, you know, kind of a three pillar approach whereby, you know, you would have a preserve, you would have a scientific research team, and then you would have a breeding facility. And so, you know, the more we chatted about it, it just kind of, you know, evolved. And so I left the zoo and was hired by what was called Project Orion at the time in June of 2009. And I really looked at that after being in the zoo field my whole life. And anybody that's been around the zoo field, you know, the biggest drawback is usually, you know, money constraints and finances and having the money to do what you want to do. And I felt quite fortunate coming on to Project Orion, Orion Society, whereby, you know, the budget for creating a facility like this was actually very generous. It was adequate amount of money to do it right. And so having that as a resource base, and you know, our conversations within the organization and yourself, of course, I really kind of took a non-linear approach to it, where this could be something more than just breeding indigo snakes. And you know, we could put together something that you could even add, as an offsite conservation center that's not relying on being open to the public, that the sky's the limit. You could really do some incredible stuff. And there were other organizations, St. Catharines Island with WSC and other organizations that did have zoos that had offsite breeding areas, and they were always like the highlight of the zoo, to be able to go to those places and see what's going on behind the scene. And so I really took a kind of a multi-species approach to it, thinking that down the road, we may not just be solely eastern indigo snakes, but a lot of other species. They might want to be reptiles, maybe we can, have a rare bird area or have some rhinos on the property or whatever it happened to be. So I really took, a kind of a multi-species, multi-purpose approach to it. And of course, just physically locating something like that, of certainly adequate size, but a position in the environment where you could add connectivity between preserve areas, or the site itself could be a corridor, was also a very important aspect to it. So it was really kind of a whole mesh, and it wasn't just me. I mean, it was you guys and the team and other people that we were engaging with at the time that created this bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. You said something there that I don't want to leave behind. I'm going to have Michelle talk to it in a little bit, but the idea of stud books, AZA stud books. So we're going to circle back to that, because I do want our listeners to learn more about that, but we'll get Michelle to talk about that in a minute. So I like, it's interesting hearing what you're saying about the idea of a breeding center being more than just the breeding and the concept of the land. And could that be an important additional component to conservation, wildlife more generally? Tell me a little bit about, and I was involved in this, but you certainly, did the bulk of the work here, but tell me a little bit about the land, not necessarily where it is today, but the process. What went into your thinking about building a state-of-the-art breeding center for snakes? We know we want it in Florida. Like, what were some of the things that were going through your mind about the land we needed to find for such an endeavor? You talked about connectivity and conservation lands. Are there maybe expand on that a little bit? But there are other. Did it need to be certain size? For security or for outside activities? I'm just curious, kind of some of your thought process when you were thinking about finding the right piece of land for this.
Well, of course, the primary objective is indigo snakes. And indigos from southern Georgia down to the Keys, have a pretty latitudinal distribution, kind of north-south. And so I know at one point you said, hey, Fred, you can locate this place anywhere you want, and that just really created a lot of amazing options for me. But, knowing that this was going to be kind of a complicated project, I thought, and of course I lived here in Central Florida, but locating the Indigo Center in the center of its range, in case there were variables associated with the environments being different in Southern Florida than Southern Georgia type thing. And so I was pretty much focused on, Central Florida and finding, property here. I early on, I did a lot of driving around looking at things that were for sale and property, et cetera. Always thought the bigger, the better. If you have an opportunity to buy land, buy property, make it as big as you can. And the other important aspect is having it back up to, you know, property, say state owned, federally or whatever, that that was also preserved or, you know, managed property that wasn't going to be developed. And so there is a certain amount of remoteness to the site that would, you know, prove real beneficial, not only for what you're doing environmentally, but also just, you know, people, you know, access to the general public and things like that. So I early on got together with Keith Hsu, who was working with the Nature Conservancy locally. And he really influenced me, I think, a lot about connectivity. And right here where we're located is the Wakaiva Basin, which is a big green space in East Lake County. And then north of us is Ocala National Forest. And between those two big preserve areas, those green spaces, there's a significant bear population. And there are three major highways, east-west highways that intersect that whole, you know, kind of region. And every year, about 60 bears are being hit by cars and killed, you know, just trying to travel, you know, and move around within those home ranges. And so it was just very easy to jump to the point, well, boy, if we can also, you know, throw the variable into the equation of having connectivity for bears and everything else in between, you know, preserve areas, that would just be ideal. And so the property that we ended up closing on here on the north side backs up to Seminole State Forest. On the south side, there's like one lot and then Seminole State Forest again. And so, I think we successfully, for the 25 acres we have, you know, made that element happen. And so that was another, you know, big part about the concept. 25 acres, and the property itself has two spring-fed ponds, some elevational changes, and going up a little hill, and some real nice habitat, which we should burn at some point real quick. We've talked about that. And this property itself, I think, worked out very nice, you know, for all those reasons.
Great. I agree. It's really just an amazing property. It's kind of a magical place to go see, tucked away into this wild part of Central Florida, and just the aesthetics of how the property lays out. And then you go into these buildings and you've got hundreds and hundreds of snakes. What more could you want? So pretty amazing. Speaking about the buildings, first of all, you know, there are multiple buildings that are used for different things and structures outside. Can you tell us a little bit about the different components of the center, the different buildings, you know, just fairly briefly, and what they're used for and why you decided that we needed those components initially?
Well, the what existed on the property, I think you signed the closing documents in November of 2010, and existing here at that time was a house, a barn, kind of a workroom, and then the rest was undeveloped, basically. And so the components that we turned the house into office, library, you know, working space for staff. The other outbuildings that were existing, you know, supported just kind of physical plant type activities. And so the three components that, you know, needed to come into play was a medical building, a clinic for, you know, any supportive veterinary work and quarantine and those types of activities. And then a large herpetarium, so to speak, where you would be housing the animals in an indoor facility, kind of in a great room kind of concept where, you know, if you were working rack systems or other types of enclosures and caging, you had a lot of flexibility on setup and weren't really confined to individual little rooms, although there are two individual rooms associated with that design. And then the other part was, which was actually the most exciting to me, was doing outdoor enclosures for indigo snakes. And so we're right here in the middle of the range. It's perfect for those guys to live outside all year round, as long as they're provided with refugia and the, you know, the proper elements that they need. And it just seemed ideal to really focus on, you know, outdoor enclosures where things like, you know, temperature, sunlight, seasonal changes in photo period, raining, you know, have a snake be out in the rain and all these things that are very difficult to manipulate or create when you're indoors. We're automatically there and natural to them. And so, yeah, those three components really were the main push on, you know, developing the different aspects for a successful program.
Yeah, so we build, buy this land and we build these facilities. And so then we have this great facility and we need to fill it with snakes and begin the breeding program. And, you know, so there's a current story to this as well that Michelle will certainly speak to, but I'm curious if you remember those early days of developing the indigo snake breeding population in particular, but we also had a fair number of other species and you know, some other conservation programs really within the facility at the time. I'm just curious if you could speak to how we started and launched that breeding program and get the animals into the facilities. Where did they come from? How do we get them? And certainly, as anybody could imagine, there's a lot of controversy around, you know, a federally listed species and breeding programs and animals and how you get them. So there's a lot of controversy around this. But I'm just curious to get your take on how we built up that breeding population, as you were certainly one that started that at the facility.
Yeah. Actually, you know, another part. So, you know, by the time that you signed and we closed on the property, and by the time we built these other buildings, and we got the certificate of occupancy here at the OC for our activities in January of 2012. So it was a good year and a half between closing and actually having a facility for indigo snakes. And of course, like with any endeavor like this, there's lots of things that you have to do, you know, both on a regulatory basis, on a design and planning, architects, you know, we had Borelli and Partner out of Winter Park. And I took in line drawings on graph paper of the building layouts. And they were able to take those after, you know, a lot of discussions and turn those into, you know, real architectural drawings. We worked with LPG urban and regional planners to help with all the regulatory things. And so we had to go through zoning, site plan, permitting. We added a conservation easement on the west side of the property. And some of that was kind of new for Lake County and the county commissioners and the residents that owned property that was contiguous with the OCIC property weren't real keen on a reptile snake center being built in their backyard. And so we had to go through a lot of hurdles. And I got a call one time when we were about to go in for our zoning request in front of the commissioners the night before, and it was from an attorney in Mount Dora. And he goes, "Hey, I had an office filled with angry neighbors of yours, and they don't want a snake farm out there," and all this kind of stuff. So we had to actually postpone that and back up. And I did a lot of kind of talking to the neighbors about, you know, what this thing was really all about. And it was originally posted in the paper as being an indigo snake facility. And that's what the county commission was going to approve. And I felt that we couldn't get it approved by that we had to go more broad. And so we pushed it back again and went forward with a reptile and amphibian, which then, oh, does that mean you can have a bunch of cobras out there, you know, and that kind of thing. So, some pushback, but we were able to kind of massage that. And, eventually everybody became, good friends, and they understood what this project was all about. And the one thing that we had, and it's really interesting about the indigo snake, because by focusing on indigos, it was actually probably the easiest snake to these local people to really kind of engender some positive feelings. You know, we're all aware about what most people think about snakes, but, you know, even if a rancher or a farmer or, you know, a local rural person didn't particularly like snakes, they would always go, yeah, but the indigo snake is a good snake because it eats rattlesnakes. And so they had this image that, wow, you're going to be breeding indigo snakes. Well, that's actually a pretty good snake. And so indigos were, you know, more than probably any other species, you know, in the local lore, was probably the easiest snake to get these people on board with, and maybe even the only one. I'm not sure, but. So that kind of all, you know, went behind us, and once we got through all the regulatory processes, we hired Evergreen Construction Management to actually, you know, be on site to work with the subs as the general contractor, and basically within 6 months, those facilities were built. So to get back to your question, Chris, establishing the breeding population here, because we didn't have the facility initially when, you know, I got involved in this project, somebody that was on the board of Central Florida Zoo offered a building on her property. And so I started gathering up indigo snakes and housing them there until this place was finished, so we could get a jump start on establishing the colony. And those animals, of course, and you may talk about it more, but primarily were derived from the project that involved Auburn University, Georgia DNR, and the Orient Society in collecting gravid females, taking them to Auburn, lay eggs, hatch, taking those females back, releasing them at the point of capture. And so that was the basis of our real, in quotations, indigos. But I had also gathered some up and got breeding loans from zoos and also the private sector. That private sector has always been, relatively strong with indigo snakes and private collections. And there's certainly a segment of private collectors that really focus on dry mark on the genus itself and have, projects with many of those species. And so it could just kind of grew from there as far as, you know, getting those different sources together, recognizing and logging them into the stud book and knowing what their genetic or not knowing what their genetic background is, and then orchestrating who would be put together, you know, age-wise, origin, genetic composition, et cetera, to start in on producing snakes that were relative to be released back into the wild.
Great. Yeah. You know, I even forgot about that part, you know, you bringing the snakes into that facility before OCIC opened up. I forgot about that. That's great.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Central Florida Zoo and the partnership, but first I want to introduce Michelle, because I do want her to talk a little bit about the zoo. So you've been sitting there patiently and quietly while Fred and I have been going back and forth, but I want to hear, who are you? Why don't you just tell everybody, introduce yourself and, you know, who are you? Where do you live? What are you doing these days?
Sure. So I was actually born and raised in Florida. My family is all from Wisconsin, so they moved down to Florida in the 80s, and my dad and mom ran a leather shop out of Daytona Beach, and I grew up on a little lake in Volusia County, and kind of just spent a lot of time outdoors camping. My parents were really into camping, so as kids, we would always go out in mostly to the Ocala National Forest, actually, which is funny because we're right down the road from the Ocala National Forest here at the OCIC. And I had always, as a kid, wanted to be a zookeeper. So I didn't really have any sort of specific interests. I always thought, you know, my mom would say, well, if you want to be a zookeeper, maybe you want to work with monkeys or cats or something cute and cuddly. And I was kind of always like, okay, well, yeah, that sounds nice, but it didn't turn out that way. So I was going to school at Seminole Community College at the time, and I was driving past the zoo, because that's the road that I took to go to school. And I stopped in one day because I thought, well, what better way to get into the zoo field than to just stop in and talk to somebody and see what's going on there and see if they have anything available for me, something like that. So I stop in and I go back to the administration office and I ask if they have any positions available. And they said, yeah, you know, we always usually have something available, so let me give you an application. And so they gave me an application. I filled it out right there on site and gave it back to them, got home and got a call back for an interview. So I go into my interview and I'm sitting there in my interview and they say, well, you know, you're applying for a position in guest services. And I said, well, I didn't know that I was applying for a position in guest services. I've always wanted to get more involved with animals. So I went home and I got a call back and I got hired at the zoo. And so that kind of started me with my foot in the door in the animal world and the animal community. But I, as a kid, I always thought, you know, oh, I'm outside all the time. I'm always getting dirty. I want to just spend time in the outdoors, camping and canoeing, things like that. So I kind of always had this passion for being outside in the wildlife and conservation, things like that.
I just wanted to take a quick break and tell you guys that snakes are one of the most persecuted groups of animals in the world. Unfortunately, most snakes that encounter people end up dead. But the Orian Society is dedicated to changing that. Go to www.orian.org to learn more and join the effort to stop the persecution.
So do you have memories? You talked about growing up on a lake, and that must have been really nice. But this, you know, you talk about your mom wanting you to maybe work on the charismatic megafauna, the furry, feathery animals of the world. And but you ended up working with reptiles and amphibians. So when you were a child, do you have a lot of memories around that lake or other places? Maybe when you're out camping, was there something early on where this was instilled in you? Or is this something that kind of developed as you got into this career in the zoo field?
So I remember as a kid, because I grew up around the water, you know, always being taught to watch out for snakes. So, you know, especially cottonmouths, those were the real bad ones, according to everybody in the neighborhood. So when you see a snake around water, you know, run away by all means, you know, no, don't interact with it. And I remember being a little confused by that because I didn't really understand why they were so scary. And I just knew, oh man, those guys are no good. And so I kind of had that in the back of my mind, I think, as a kid. And I remember one instance specifically where I was at home and I was asked to go get a board game from my dad's closet. And I had to pull my little stool over because I was very, very young, and I had to pull my little stool over to reach up to the shelf where the board games were. And I remember seeing a jar of baby rattlesnakes in vinegar. And I thought to myself, wow, I was a little disturbed by it because I didn't know why there were dead animals here in this jar. And I was always fascinated with snakes and lizards and frogs and turtles and all wildlife. And so I was a little maybe surprised by seeing that. And I had asked my parents, you know, about that jar of baby rattlesnakes. And because my dad owned the leather shop, he actually used to kill rattlesnakes, kill snakes, and skin them for their hides. And he would make hat bands and belts and things like that. And so I had always seen that type of stuff around the house. And I think that that kind of sparked my fascination, although it is a negative thing. I don't really like seeing hat bands of rattlesnake skins and things like that personally, but, I think that it actually did get me interested in questioning why they were there and what it was, and appreciate the beauty a little bit too, because you get to see something up close and feel the scales, even though it is like tanned and a belt, but it was still, kind of piqued my interest.
Yeah, I think snake skins are beautiful. I have a couple hanging in my office. So, you know, so you mentioned your kind of first job in the zoo world. Which zoo was that? That wasn't Central Florida Zoo.
That was Central Florida Zoo. Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't catch that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Interesting. And, well, go ahead. Sorry.
Central Florida Zoo has produced a lot of great herpetologists.
I would agree. So let me set the stage, and then I would love to have you give us the 30,000 foot level on Central Florida Zoo very quickly, where it is and what you guys do. But, you know, so Central Florida Zoo is always a partner in the sense that Fred had that strong affiliation going back to the origins. But early on, back, I can't remember the exact year now, but, you know, say about 8 years ago, the Orianne Society, as Fred mentioned, was known as Project Orianne. And we were run as a kind of a family-oriented nonprofit. You could almost think of it as like a family foundation. We were actually something called the Private Operating Foundation, but it was similar. It was really focused around one family. And then there were some decisions made by the board that Project Orianne needed to transition and become a public charity, which is what you typically think of if you think of a nonprofit. Think of like Nature Conservancy or your local land trust or any organization like that. They're publicly funded. They're public companies, basically, public nonprofit companies. So the Project Orianne at the time, the board decided we needed to transition. So we became the Orianne Society, and we began the process of moving to where we are today with a broader mission, not exclusively focused on indigos. And at the time, we also had some serious budget issues. We still had resources, but our budgets were being cut, and we had to decide how to make some transitions. But really, we didn't want to lose any of the components there. So what we ended up doing was Fred and myself, we ended up working very closely with the Central Florida Zoo and developing a partnership to save this breeding center that we had just really completed and started the momentum on. And to where we sit today, where we're basically Orianne Site still owns the ground that the center sits on, owns the center, but the Central Florida Zoo is the organization that is running it, staffs it, is doing all of the breeding. I mean, Central Florida Zoo is the entity that basically runs the Orianne Center for Indigo Conservation. It's been a great partnership for us. Central Florida Zoo is an incredible, just the zoo itself. I've been there many times now and I've always enjoyed it. But Michelle, could you just take a second and Fred, I know you have a long history there too, so feel free to chime in, but just briefly give me that 30,000 foot level on the zoo. Where are you guys? What do you do? How does the OCIC fit into the overall zoo structure?
Yeah, the Central Florida Zoo is a relatively small zoo in Sanford, Florida. So it's actually a zoo that a lot of people don't know it's there because it's not in this downtown, you know, area where it gets a lot of traffic, like Jacksonville Zoo or Tampa or places like that. So it's a very small zoo and they focus mainly on small animals. So, and their conservation projects are mainly on with small animals, because of their size. So, the OCIC, just being that conservation partner, the zoo actually contributes significantly to conservation because they have the OCIC that they're operating. So it's really important for the zoo that to have the OCIC and be contributing to the conservation project the way that they are. Obviously, it's very expensive. So yeah, one of those things that's really neat about the Central Florida Zoo is that because it's small, very tight knit, everybody is kind of like a family there. Everybody works together. I remember when I was actually working on site at the zoo, I was working in the herpetology department. However, I was cross-trained in primates and small cats and the zoo, what they called zoo lab at the time, which is the education department, because you just had all these people that were just so passionate and wanted to help each other. We would take a whole day and go, you know, put branches and props into a bird exhibit. And it's just one of those places that you really get that feel of community. And they have a lot of really great education programs as well. So partnering with the local schools, especially in Seminole County, and providing school programs for all the kids there. And then, you know, obviously we with the OCIC do similar programs for school groups, you know, in partnership with the zoo and all of that. So it's just one of those places that really puts their heart into everything that they do. And you, that passion really shows when you visit the zoo. A lot of things have actually changed over the last 5 to 10 years, a lot of progress and some updating at the zoo and all of that. So if you haven't gone, definitely anytime recently, it's worth visiting. And it is a nonprofit. So definitely they rely on the gate, people coming in the gate, ticket sales in order to keep their operations going. So it's really important that they get a lot of community support.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think
go ahead, Fred. Sorry.
I'd like to add too that, you know, as you spoke about, you know, the transition and finding another, you know, home for the OCIC on the financial side. You know, I spoke to a lot of zoo directors in Florida to see if they were interested in a offsite conservation center that was, you know, primarily focused on reptiles and amphibians. And although it's every zoo's dream to have offsite conservation centers for, you know, breeding endangered and threatened species and doing research, and, you know, that can sometimes not really happen in traditional zoos that are, you know, constrained by their footprint in a city, financially, zoos are always operating, you know, most of them right on the line of between black and red. And to take on a conservation center was, you know, a big budget item and something that, you know, that we wanted to have happen, you know, fairly rapidly to find a partner in that aspect. And most of the directors I spoke to, although they were very interested in the concept, they couldn't reach into their wallet and do it. And for Central Florida Zoo, as Michelle described, you know, being a small zoo with very restricted, very lean finances, to step forward and, you know, with excitement to take on the OCIC was just incredible. And, you know, the match has endured. And I think it just says a lot for that organization.
I would agree with you. It's the Central Florida Zoo, like Michelle was saying, it's kind of like the equivalent of a small town community, but they stepped up big in this case, and, you know, really are running one of the leading facilities for reptile conservation. And when I say leading facilities, I mean, it's a facility that is making a difference on the ground. So it's really impressive what they've been able to do. So Michelle, tell us a little bit about the stud book. Fred mentioned that earlier, and how does that come into play if we're thinking about indigo snake breeding or breeding for any animals, really?
Yeah, the indigo snake stud book is a way, well, stud books in general, is a way to track the population of animals that are involved in the database. So the stud book that I am managing now is through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. It's just for eastern indigo snakes, and it's mainly to track the zoo or track the indigo snakes amongst the zoos in North America. So if a zoo in, I don't know, let's just pick a state like Nebraska has a snake that it's not really represented in the population for the SSP, it might be of breeding age, things like that. And that snake, for whatever reason, would match well with the snake over in, let's say, Georgia. Those animals can be paired up for breeding. And so it's managed through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. There's a population biologist that's assigned to the program. It's also, I also operate the SSP program, so the Species Survival Plan. And so those two programs kind of work in partnership with each other. And sometimes you have multiple people doing each of those positions, but because of the number of indigo snakes on site here and the involvement of the OCIC and the Central Florida Zoo, both of those programs are managed here on site. However, so all of the animals in North American zoos theoretically are entered into the stud book, and you can track the parentage, you can track the offspring, you can track all of these different lineages and things using the stud book database and make, you know, more educated decisions on breeding and transfer recommendations. So one of the things, for example, just to kind of maybe make it easier to understand, we have what we call a generic group of indigo snakes here at the OCIC. They maybe came from private breeders, or we don't really know exactly where they came from. We can't track them back to the wild for whatever reason. And we can take those snakes and breed them to animals that we know what their lineage is and hopefully add some genetic diversity into the group. I know when Fred was here at the OCIC, he actually would take some of the generics and breed them to males that we know have wild genetics or wild lineage. We can trace them back. And then we're adding it, kind of increasing the genetic diversity into the SSP group. Because indigo snakes have been protected for so long, and theoretically none are being taken from the wild for private breeding, it's important to increase the genetic diversity using these animals where we do know exactly where they came from. We assume that there's probably a lot of inbreeding in that population.
Yeah, so is there the concept behind these stud books? Sounds like it's driven more about conservation and the conservation of, say, genetic diversity within the captive population, as opposed to making sure there are enough snakes for everybody to display. Would that be an accurate statement, or is it kind of a combination there of the two?
It is a combination of the two in a way, because there is some importance to animals being used for display and education and things like that. But the primary goal is to track the animals for conservation significance in their genetic diversity and things like that. So yeah, that is the main reason that you have a stud book. You want to make sure that all of those animals can be accounted for and try to get as much information as you can on those animals to make sure that you're able to make a good breeding recommendation.
Yeah, you know, this whole topic that we're discussing is one of the interesting things that I've learned from you both, as well as other people in the zoo and captive husbandry, captive conservation world. You know, coming out of, wildlife programs, I always thought of conservation and wildlife conservation, snake conservation, as you go out and you buy this piece of land or you do this particular activity. But just the concept of the value that zoos can provide for conservation beyond the education. I mean, that's just a huge, critically important service that you're providing to wildlife and our society. But that concept that the genetic diversity of a lot of these wild animals that are being held by zoos is just a huge component of the conservation equation, if you will. I mean, there are even some species now that don't exist in the wild. They only exist in zoos. And so that's something that I really learned kind of as we've developed this captive breeding portion of the Indigo Snake Program. So, and these stud books are critically important to that. Anything you guys want to add to that before I move on?
Yeah, I think the other, you know, aspect to really kind of take in is, you know, all these zoos in AZA really operate as one collection. And so even though a gorilla may be at LA and one at Bronx, they're still part of a plan and a program to perpetuate the species with as most genetic diversity as possible. Where the constriction really lies is there's only so much space in zoos. There's only so much space on the ark, so to speak. And so, higher up than Michelle is the species survival plan coordinator for indigo snakes. But above that, structurally within AZA, there's what's referred to as taxon advisory groups. And there's a snake taxon advisory group. And the people that sit on that board actually make decisions on what species are going to be in zoos, because there's only so much space. And you need a certain amount of space in order to have a self-sustained viable population going. And so you've got to pick and choose who's going to be in zoos for conservation purposes. And I've always thought that, you know, animals would be lining up outside the gate of the zoo if they knew that that was the real story, and they'd want to get in, because the ones that are left out there a lot of times, and going forward over the next, you know, 40, 80 years, it's going to be a whole different scene out there. And so the animals that are involved in these SSP programs are very fortunate. A lot of people don't appreciate the evolution that zoos have gone through in the last 40, 50 years. And they have become very science-based, very humane, doing, you know, a lot of behavioral conditioning, you know, to eliminate stress, and, you know, great, you know, variety of nutritional support, husbandry, veterinary services, all that has evolved very rapidly. And people need to really appreciate the changes that zoos have gone through, you know, over the last few decades. And, every zoo person in the world, every zookeeper would love to have their animals released back into the wild, you know, and not ever see an animal in captivity. But that wild just doesn't exist for most species. And if it does, and those species do exist out there, they've kind of got their carrying capacity on what they're up against. And so, you know, this debate between captive husbandry and reproduction and reintroduction, release programs is quite an equation, quite a balance.
Yeah, great. So it's all fascinating stuff. In the stud book, So Michelle, like, for example, I mean, the OCIC is now run, as we talked about, by the Central Florida Zoo. But let's say we go back in time and it was run by Project Orion, or the Orion Society. It's not just zoo animals that are incorporated into the stud book. Could a nonprofit like Orion Society have a collection of animals that are part of this stud book population? How does that work?
Yeah, of course. So anybody can ask to have their indigo snakes as part of the stud book. The only thing that I think that might get lost in that is that if that animal becomes valuable somewhere down the line, it's important that there's flexibility in offering to breed the animal, or maybe send the animal out, or maybe swap the animal for another one, in order to make sure that animal is used for the conservation project. So there are many nonprofits in the stud book, and every year they offer information over to, did their animal breed, or did their animal get sick? Did it die? Did they, hatch out any new animals? So as long as there's a good transfer of information back and forth between the stud bookkeeper and the individual with the animals, it's a really productive partnership. And I think that it'd be very important to have more private entities involved in the SSP and the stud book, and their animals included in the stud book. Right now, there are about 200 animals in the stud book, and about 150 of those are at the OCIC. So we're making a big effort to send out more animals that can't be included in the reintroduction program because we don't know their lineage, and also getting more zoos to try to breed the indigo snakes. We're making more pairing recommendations just to satisfy the need for indigo snakes within zoos and private and education centers and things like that. So over the last couple of years, we've actually, before it was only OCIC that was producing indigo snakes to use in the SSP population amongst the zoos, not involved in the reintroduction program. But over the last couple of years, we've actually had Jacksonville Zoo that's been successful producing indigo snakes, and North Carolina Zoo that has been very successful breeding and hatching indigo snakes. So I think that it's becoming more of an exciting thing amongst zoos. Everybody always wants indigo snakes because they're this big, beautiful, charismatic snake. And so it's very helpful to have other zoos that are successfully producing them just for the future of the program.
Yeah, that's great. So 150 indigo snakes, that's pretty incredible. And I know that you know you're breeding them in most years, and actually just shared a photo of one of the, I guess it was the first one to hatch. Is that right? Just the other day on Instagram, I saw. Actually, Fred was holding it. So, yeah, I shared that or reposted it. Anyways, so you have all these snakes and you have this breeding program. We can talk about the husbandry and how you keep them day to day, but what I'm really interested in is the breeding and how your husbandry is designed to promote successful breeding. So maybe just talk to us a little bit about your current breeding program at the OCIC, and you can bring in those husbandry aspects that are important to the breeding.
Okay, so we keep a pretty obviously a number of indigo snakes here at the OCIC. And not all of them that are involved in the breeding and reintroduction program get bred every year. So if there is one that is just slightly smaller this year than it was the year before, or it's just not quite the right age, maybe it's just not making a good pair with one of the males that we have. Not every female gets bred every year. So although we do have a lot of snakes involved in the breeding and reintroduction program, not every single one of them will contribute offspring every year. So one of the really neat things about the OCIC is that we do have these outdoor units, as Fred was explaining. And so we can try to keep them in these naturalistic environments. And they have a lot of space, they can climb, they can go underground, they're exposed to UV, the seasonal temperature changes, all of these things that might be cues for breeding. And indigo snakes, they start breeding in October and typically breed until January or February. And that temperature change is really important to trigger them to breed. So having them housed in these outdoor enclosures at the OCIC, they get that natural exposure to those temperature adjustments. And a lot of times that will trigger them to breed. So, it makes it a lot easier for us. So the animals that are housed indoors, we do have to adjust the thermostat and drop the temperatures a little bit lower in order to try to mimic that natural seasonal shift. So typically these animals are housed in their outdoor enclosures. There's one per enclosure, and we would take one of the animals that we're going to pair with the other and move it into the other's enclosure. So like last year, for example, I had more success moving females into males' enclosures. And so these are all things that we just experiment with year after year to determine which way is going to be the most successful. So we would move the female over into the male's enclosure, and we observe for sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes 3 or 4 hours. And so it's a really long process, and we never really know exactly how the snakes are going to react to one another. So, you know, put the female into the male's enclosure, and usually the male will see her right away. They're very, you know, they're very visual, so they can pick up on that movement real fast from the other snake coming in. And it doesn't always end up great. So sometimes if the male's hungry, he'll go over, and you can kind of see this feeding response coming on. And just working with indigo snakes for so long, you can usually tell right away. But when it goes well, the male will actually go start courting the female in these outdoor enclosures. And the space is really helpful for that, because they're such big animals that they will stretch out. They'll go underground together. They'll come back out. One of them will go up the tree and then come back down. So it's a whole process that they go through, in order to court one another and, you know, result in copulation. So, in that way, the outdoor units are really amazing, and we get some really interesting behaviors from observations and stuff from those animals, you know, courting one another and breeding in the outdoor enclosures. Every once in a while, we actually will combat the males with one another as well. And that is where you would put two males together. This is a natural thing that would happen in the wild with many species of snakes. So you would actually put the two males together in these enclosures, and they would go through a combat routine. And this is pretty much just the snakes just trying to dominate one another. And they'll intertwine their bodies. There's a lot of hissing. They're using every little bit of energy to overpower the other male. And you can usually tell when one's getting pretty tired, and so we remove them. We separate them at that time. When one gets really exhausted, we'll separate them and then put the female in there with them. So it's definitely a whole process for breeding season. Usually, you know, 2 to 3 pairs each day are attempted. And out of 10 pairs, maybe in a week, you might get 2 successful breeding events, or you might get 7. So it just depends on the individuals. It depends on the environment. The weather is very important for them. So all of these different things that play into whether it's going to be successful or not. So
will you breed a given female, will you potentially breed her to multiple males in the same season? Or how do you manage that, the concept of, you know, potential multiple paternity and those types of things?
We haven't done that in recent years. However, this year, this coming fall, we've been talking about experimenting with multiple parentage, because obviously a lot of other, it's been documented in a lot of other reptiles that multiple parentage is important for the fertility of the eggs. And so we've actually been discussing coming up with a plan on how to do that, because we want to be able to tell who the father is. But if both of them and all of the snakes are involved in the reintroduction program, we can just track, and there's actually a way to track all of that in the stud book as well. So you can track that as a 2 potential sires in the stud book. And so, yeah, I think that we will probably learn a lot from that. And we might be able to answer some of our questions about fertility of indigo snakes, if that is a successful method to use to increase fertility. Fred, did you ever breed females to multiple males when you guys were doing them?
We did not. And it was mainly, I think that it would be an interesting thing to do, though, and see what kind of effect, you know, that may have on clutch viability. But we didn't, just because we were very concerned about keeping the genetics well known. And so, I think that's something that, you know, you could probably, you know, venture into now, you know, but back then when we had such a limited number of animals, we just really wanted to know who was who.
Yeah.
And I think that had a lot to do also with, we were kind of managing these different colonies of indigo snakes and all of that. And the second reintroduction site came about, and, you know, there was a lot of discussion with the reintroduction committee and all the partners on how to manage those, different populations of indigo snakes per se, you know, South Florida animals versus, you know, the Southeast Georgia animals and things like that. But, you know, now that the colony has gotten so much bigger and we've gained so many breeders, just from retaining animals, the offspring that we've produced and things like that, it'll make it a lot easier to be able to experiment with that.
Yeah. I think you have a lot more options now of playing around with that and seeing where that goes.
Yeah. So we built these outdoor enclosures and Fred talked about building them and the concept of all these environmental conditions that the snakes could experience. It's also my understanding that historically zoos in general have had a lot of difficulty breeding indigo snakes in captivity. It's great to hear that there are a couple of them that are really doing well with that. And part of the concept when we built these, and you can correct me, Fred, but part of the concept was, you know, we thought that if these snakes had these outside environments, they had UV light and you know, experience the environment, we could be more successful in having viable clutches. So you feel free to correct me if I'm a little bit wrong on that, but that's the way I understood it. And I'm just curious, Michelle and Fred, how valuable do you think those outdoor enclosures have been, and how critical are they for, you know, breeding programs like this?
Well, I think initially they were, you tend to want to, bolster an approach with as many positive natural variables you can possibly have. And so if you were going to err on anything about having a snake set up indoors, whether it was, you know, a thermal gradient, UV light, you know, being rained on, cyclic, seasonal changes, that's most easily accomplished outside. And so we just kind of did that naturally just to make sure we were covering those if those individual elements were important or, they were requisites for, good reproduction. And I think Michelle can talk more about this, but certainly there have been, a number of private indigo breeders that have been very successful all indoors, without using outdoor enclosures. And so it's hard to tell at this point. Have you kind of looked at different things and where, sometimes, they're, even though they're outside, they really didn't need UV light or they really didn't need to get rained on, and those kind of things. And those are kind of superfluous to success.
Yeah. When the outdoor units have their own challenges, especially here in Florida, we get a lot of rain, especially during hurricane season, and the water levels come up really high. And so we have run into some challenges with the outdoor units and have had to move snakes in. And so that kind of started the experimentation on, I guess we need to breed the snakes inside this year while we fix up our outdoor enclosures. And so we did, and we were very successful breeding them inside and didn't really notice much of a difference in the production of the clutches or the snake's behavior or anything like that. But we can't pin that to one thing or another because, they've been housed outside for 3 or 4 years and we just moved them inside and bred them. We can't really say that them being inside for a short period, did anything. They were outside for 3 years before that. So you can't really tell much based on that. But now we have some of our breeders that we do keep inside. They might be a little bit smaller, or some of them just don't do as well outside. Each individual in our outdoor units anyways. But we kept some of them inside. And we've actually bred them in, bigger enclosures. We've actually even bred some of them in rack systems, and we're very successful doing that. So I can't really say that the outdoor units are crucial, for the success of the breeding of the snakes. But obviously there are still a lot of benefits to keeping them in these natural environments. And over time, I do think that there could be some negative impacts to keeping them indoors, out of the UV, out of these natural environments for their entire lives. I think fitness has a lot to do with it, giving them the space to roam as a, you know, wide-ranging species. I think that those, you know, movements and the activity levels just being higher in the outdoor enclosures could play an important role, especially in females or bigger snakes in general. When you keep them inside, you know, anybody's going to have limited space indoors. And those outdoor enclosures just give them so much room to roam. So I do think that there are a lot of perks to the outdoor units. I don't necessarily think that it's critical to get them to breed, but obviously it's going to be beneficial.
Yeah, I know it varies a lot year to year potentially, but how many indigo snakes are you currently approximately producing for reintroduction? Not snakes that you have. You already mentioned you currently have 150, but on average these days, how many snakes do we have to put back into the wild, and what are your kind of goals for the near future on that?
On average, we produce anywhere from like 40 to 50 indigo snakes per year that can be used in the reintroduction program. And that's just over the last, you know, probably since 2014, when we had a really, really good productive year. And like you said, it's different every year. Some years we get 35 snakes and some years we get 55 or 60. So it just differs year to year. Our goal is to produce enough for each of the reintroduction sites, which are, it's 60 per year for the two reintroduction sites, 30 at each site. So our goal would be to produce enough for the two reintroduction sites, but also produce more than that, so that way we can retain animals for future breeding efforts. So if we were able to produce the number for the reintroduction, but also produce extra for retention for the breeding program, that would be ideal. So that way we have, you know, anytime an animal gets too old or has to be retired from the breeding animal, we have another, generation of animals coming into the picture for breeding. That would be ideal. So, in 2017, I did retain more females than we have in the past. I retained, I think it was 8. And so hopefully in the next year or two, we'll have those 8 females coming into circulation for breeding. And we can try to get to our goal of, 60 plus animals for the breeding and reintroduction program.
Great. Well, you mentioned reintroduction, and I had wanted to talk about that today, but we're already at an hour and 20 minutes. So I think we're going to have another group of people, and we'll do a deep dive on indigo snake reintroductions and reintroductions of other species in the future. But I do want to give you any last things, any interesting tidbits that you want to mention about the indigo snake breeding program, whether it be hurdles, whether it be, I know we're head starting animals, anything really critical that we didn't touch on that you think is important for the breeding program and worth mentioning?
Thanks. So I think that supporting the zoo would be a huge help to the indigo snake program, because they do provide significant funding for this project. And, that partnership with the zoo and the Orient Society is critical for the, success of the reintroduction program and getting animals out on the ground. So any way that, people can support the zoo, visit the zoo, spread the word about the reintroduction program and that partnership, that would be really helpful. You can also follow us on social media and follow the zoo as well. We have an Instagram that is @indigo_center and a Facebook page, which is Orient Center for Indigo Conservation, Central Florida Zoo. And there's donation opportunities for anybody who feels generous, that all of those things help. And, that supports not just the reintroduction program, but research that's going on with the species, whether it's the reproduction, disease research. there are a lot of different aspects to the program that by supporting the partners and supporting the project is ultimately benefiting the survival of the species.
Yeah, and I want to further that plug a little bit on the zoo. And sorry, Fred, and then I'll give it back to you. But I will say that we talked about this being a small town zoo, but I've been lucky enough to kind of get a behind the scenes tour multiple times of the, you know, the reptile facility. And in particular with snakes, for its size, Central Florida Zoo to me is batting, you know, way above their average. I was just really impressed. And if you're interested in snakes, and you're going through Central Florida, there's quite a snake collection at the zoo itself, you know, let alone the OCIC. The other thing I'd say about the zoo is it's certainly worth a visit, you know, if you have kids or anything like that. It's in recent years, and you guys can correct me, but it seems like it's much more than that, and that there's all kinds of activities there for people. You obviously have the snakes and the animals, but there's zip lining and all these other type of exciting activities. So I would encourage people to go down. And I would ask you, is the zoo open given our current situation with COVID? Is it currently open?
Yeah, it is open. I believe they're still doing right now limited capacity and, you know, obviously making sure that everybody is social distancing, that sort of thing. And periodically, I believe that the herbarium has been open and closed just based on the state regulations and things. So if you're in Florida and you're planning a visit, definitely check with the state and county regulations to make sure that you get to see everything that you want to see. But yeah, I mean, this is an ever-changing environment. So, you know, when somebody plans on going, just make sure that you're following the guidelines and things like that. And it's definitely worth a visit. Splash park's open. Everything outside is 100% open. So, yep.
Great. You mentioned donating. If somebody did want to support this indigo snake breeding program, where do they go to make a donation that will specifically go to the OCIC?
The Central Florida Zoo has a website page specifically for the OCIC. It is www.centralfloridazoo.org/aboutthezoo/OCIC. And there's a donate button right on there. And you know, it's pretty easy to get to once you navigate the page and all of that. And, there's a donate button right on there and that money goes directly to the OCIC and the Indigo Snake Program.
Great. Fred, I cut you off there. Do you have any final thoughts on the breeding program and the history of the center and all of that?
Yeah, I just wanted to support what Michelle was saying, you know, as far as, you know, financial support for the program. And, I mean, we didn't have an opportunity to really, you know, talk about other things, other species focus, but Michelle has developed a fantastic program for captive breeding and reintroduction of the striped newt, for example. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of things colliding right now in the world that makes, you know, having extra funds to donate to facilities and conservation purposes pretty tight. And, you know, that's certainly understandable. You know, money does play a huge part of the equation on what you can accomplish and how much of your vision you can actually, you know, succeed in a reasonable amount of time. So thoroughly support all the information Michelle has given on how to do that. And we hope that people take that into consideration.
Great. Well, I like to finish these podcasts. I've said it before, but as a lot of people know, I'm a very avid sportsman, and you know, us hunters, we sit around campfires and tell stories. And I get just as excited about a good snake story as I do a good hunting story. So, I would like to hear your best snake story. We'll start with you, Fred. Is there a memorable experience you've had? I know you've had a lot of them, but tell us one of your great snake stories that comes to mind.
Well, I guess one that kind of jumps out is, you know, as a little kid and looking back at old natural history books and Dittmars and things like that, there was always this iconic picture of a bushmaster, a decapitated head of a bushmaster. I think it was maybe in the American Museum of Natural History. And its fangs are hanging out of the fang sheath and its tongue's hanging out. It just looks like the, just the most amazingly wicked image you could imagine. I've always been fascinated with Bushmasters. When I first moved to Florida, Barney Tomberlin sent me a little hatchling, which I raised up. And I met George Van Horn in 1975. And in 1982, we started making trips down to Central America, to Costa Rica, collecting trips, you know, getting all the paperwork and all that jazz. And on our second trip, we would collect at night with headlamps on. And we went over this side of the edge in Pavones, a little town between Securities and Turrialba. And about sundown, at about 2 o'clock in the morning, we came down this little canyon. There's a little rise in the middle of the stream. And there was a little 3-foot Bushmaster just coiled up, head kind of raised up in a kind of a hunting position. And, you know, all these, you know, we had about five guys and all the headlights on them. We're all just totally flabbergasted that, you know, we came across a little Bushmaster. And so we take photos of them and we bagged them up and we went back up to Pavones, and our friend, Alexis, who had a little bar there, we got him out of bed about 2 o'clock to show him the snake. And he's going, oh, what are these gringos up to now? He comes across the street, opens up his little bar, and we let the Bushmaster go on the floor. It was like this little wooden building, and little had we realized it was so easy to bag him because he was just, you know, we were all very calm. But in that process, a two-hour hike walking back out of the canyon that night, he was a little on edge. And so he started pretty much advancing on us all and, you know, kind of making us, you know, hop around the bar for a while. We finally got him back in the bag, but just a wonderful memory of, you know, I know Dittmar's made, you know, a number of trips down in Central America looking for Bushmasters, never caught one. And I just felt, you know, and he was certainly a much better man, much better herpetologist than I. And I just felt so fortunate to be able to, you know, have that experience. It's just, I'll never forget it.
That's great. I, too, have made multiple trips to Latin America looking for Bushmasters and have never seen one in the wild. As you know, Fred, Bushmasters are also one of my favorite animals on the planet. They're just incredible. So thank you for that story.
You had one in your office for a while.
I did. And so, Michelle, tell us your Bushmaster story.
Actually, I do have one. There was actually, we had Bushmasters here, you remember, for a couple of years. And there was one that was in a vision cage, and it was on, like, kind of face level. And this was a black-headed Bushmaster. Wow. No, this was a Central American Bushmaster.
Okay.
And, yeah, the Sinophores, right?
Yeah.
And so I opened one, and I had never seen a Bushmaster come flying out of a cage before. You know, that feeding
response.
And I had only worked with a couple South American Bushmasters at the zoo, and the cage was, you know, big. You kind of had to walk into the exhibit or whatever. And I did open the glass one day, and Fred taught me, when you open that glass, you better stand off to the side because that thing's coming out. You know, that heat sensing ability is just intense. And it did. It came
it's
flying
funny,
right out.
Funny, he never told me that.
Yeah, you had to learn for yourself. But it did. Flying out and landed right on the center aisle of that center thing. But it was so big, half of its body was still in, and half of it was out. But yeah, that was impressive. But that's not my story.
Okay, tell us your story.
So this actually happened at the OCIC a few years ago. We had a program that we were doing offsite. I think it was actually at the zoo. And I came in, I opened up everything at the OCIC, turned on the lights on, all that sort of thing, and left site real fast to go to this program. And I started getting a little bit behind, and I thought, you know, I have to go back to the OCIC and, you know, feed some of the snakes and all of that. So I got back to the OCIC and the lights were on because I had opened up that morning and all of that. And I go up to the herpetarium and I go inside, and I guess I forgot that I had set the alarm on or turned the alarm on before I left property. So the alarm was going off and I didn't realize it was going off. And I'm up there doing all, you know, some husbandry and feeding the snakes, and these two state troopers pull onto the property and come down to the office. And I was by myself at the time. Everybody else was still packing up from the program. And so I was thinking, oh no, you know, what's happening? Why are these state troopers here? So I start walking down to the office and they're coming up to meet me and they're like, excuse me, ma'am, you know, can we help you? And I'm thinking like, no, like, yeah, I work here, you know? And so they're like, well, there's an alarm going off here, burglary alarm. And I'm thinking, oh no, they think I'm like burglarizing this place. I'm robbing it. And so I was kind of like, no, no, I work here. I work here. And they became fascinated about what this place was. So they say, you know, well, you know, what's going on here? What is this place? And I was like, well, we actually breed indigo snakes for introduction and try to, you know, explaining it to them a little bit. They're like, well, can you show us around? And I was like, oh man, I'm already behind. Sure. So I show them around for about an hour and a half. And it was very cool. They were really appreciative. It was awesome. And I go back up to the herpetarium to continue my work. And first thing, I'm already behind, already stressed out, just did all of the stuff. Open one of the indigo snake enclosures and it latches onto my finger. It was a feeding response and it just grabs my finger. And I'm just thinking, this is the worst, you know. But the good thing about the story is that I suppose I made a good impression on the officers that came on site because they brought us cookies for about once a month for the next 3 months. So that was pretty pretty nice.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. It was just one of those things that it's like, what else could go wrong? And, you know, setting the alarm off and then getting bit and then being all behind. It was just one of those days, but I can laugh about it now. So that's good.
Well, that's great. I wanted to just thank you both. It's been really good to talk to you both again. And I know I've taken a lot of your time today. So
thank you.
No problem. Keep up the good work. And I wanted to thank our audience and just tell everybody to remember that snakes are animals too, and it's a privilege to see one in the wild.